But the explanation for phlogiston was that a thing burns because every substance contains phlogiston, and when it burns, the phlogiston leaves it. That's why it's reduced to ashes. And of course, Lavoisier came along with the puzzling fact that if the phlogiston leaves the material, why does it weigh more afterwards? And on the basis of that, he propounded the whole idea of the theory of oxidation, which is exactly what happens if the process of combustion is that the oxygen combines with the substance, there is nothing leaving it.
That's right. It was just exactly the opposite of what the scientists later found out. In other words, phlogiston was taken away in burning, whereas actually, as Ben points out, by oxidizing, something was added.
The point is that you have to capture all of the products of this combustion in order to prove.
So you have to
recapture the phlogiston along with
something else.
You have to prove.
But to me, this whole problem centers around one of flying saucers, centers around truth. It doesn't matter really what we believe individually or how much we talk. The truth is going to still stay regardless of what we think and what we talk. We can argue ourselves blue in the face. It's not going to change truth then. During the Middle Ages and later, many, many peasants saw meteors and they reported these. And the lords and ladies of the manor did not choose to believe because they themselves had not seen them. And many peasants were executed and many others treated to very inhuman cruelty. It didn't change the fact of the meteors. They still remain and were later proven to be so. The saucers have been seen by very many credible witnesses. Whether we believe or disbelieve isn't going to change this any. Therefore, I feel quite sure, based on the number of men and their qualifications, that they are going to have their sightings proven to be facts. For example, we have Dr. Kalaszewski, who is formerly Chief Engineer General Mills, and now Navy Cosmic Ray Project. Well, this man is quite an individual.
Yeah, but what does he say? What did he say? That's the important thing.
Well, no doubt, in the general overall, John, they would call them UFOs.
Now, exact words are not stated here.
I don't think anybody has ever denied the fact that possibly there are things in the sky that cannot be identified. I think this is quite possible, but
Machines, John, not just things in the sky, but machines.
These are machines. Is that General Mills?
A formerly Chief Engineer at General Mills. He's on a Navy Cosmic Ray Project.
All right, fine. And this man claims that he saw a machine?
Tantamount to a machine, which would act like a machine as far as we know machines. In other words, which through their maneuvers, as Admiral Farney pointed out, would seem to be intelligently controlled. Machines, something which are real, something which are physical.
Not just a flash in the sky or a light. That's right. They're not just plain white.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Lincoln LaPaz, who is director of the New Mexico Institute of Meteoritics. Now, here's a man, an expert on meteorites. He believes, because he has seen himself. And
You think we're going out a little bit too much on the limb, quoting these men, though, Carl, when we say he believes?
These men have put themselves down in record, John, as believing that there are UFOs, which are intelligently controlled machines from outer space.
I don't understand what that means. Does that mean that they may be coming here from another planet, that they're interplanetary, when you say from outer space?
Yes, Dad. It means that. They don't know where they come from, whether they're planets or from the
outer space Earth. Nobody knows. Run up in the center of the Earth. That was another theory, the Hollow Earth theory.
Well, I don't know. Lester, I couldn't answer that.
About the Hermans, don't you remember? And they come up out of the middle of the Earth.
That's why this becomes relational.
Well, they believe that a lot. We're just considering comparative probability in this case, and it seems that the probability of a hollow Earth or the whole Earth is less than the probability of a machine arriving from some other planet.
I believe in a hollow set of Earth theory before, and it's on the probabilities of out-of-space vehicles.
Well, there are some mechanical problems involved. Principally, the fact that after you get down a few miles, the pressure there is sufficient to extrude rock into any hole, into any opening. And you have to create some new physical theories before you can accept the hollow.
What about an extraterrestrial space vehicle that can travel between galaxies?
If you can accept their ability
to do such fantastic traveling, if they have so much energy, if they can build these saucers, it seems likely to me that they would have sufficient energy and sufficiently good structural materials to withstand this absolutely fantastic pressure.
Now, we cannot figure out how it could be done.
That's entirely true in either case, but we're just considering comparative. It seems that the problems of interplanetary space are less than the problems of Earth. Perhaps not a great deal.
If what you suggest, Lester, would be true, that they have these fantastic abilities, that may account for the lack of competent contact with the flying saucers. The inhabitants or the pilots of these flying saucers may consider the human race as just so many cockroaches crawling around on the surface of the planet. And why bother with cockroaches?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily consider that unintelligent over my time.
I would agree with you.
Well, actually, when these things are seen, they appear from far away. In other words, as though they were coming in toward the Earth, and then they disappear in the same direction, which is probably a fairly reasonable assumption to make, that they don't go back into the Earth. Ben, you raised the point about how could they come from outer space. After all, our Milky Way galaxy is 100 billion planets and stars, as you know, and there are billion galaxies. Now, the idea that this is the only intelligent planet after our centuries of wars and hatred, I don't think that we are so intelligent.
Yeah, but that's the point that's brought up over and over again. It's quite true that it's mathematically possible that there are probably trillions of planets that are exactly the same as the Earth, except for one thing. There was a very brilliant article written by Willie Lane
pointing out one single thing that people
overlook in this process, is that aside from the fact that the present theory is that the universe was all created at one time, that all the planets are actually in real time the same age, there is such a thing that you can call the age of a planet, and by that he meant that, say, the Earth is a younger planet than Mars, and that Venus is a younger planet than the Earth. In other words, that the water, the vapor hasn't dried up, and that the rocks haven't cooled on Venus, I think, is one of the theories. And all that. This can refer to as the age of a planet. Now, the mathematical probability of these trillions of planets that may be quite similar to the Earth, say, 92 million miles from their sun, and the sun's maybe similar and all the rest of it. The mathematical probability that you will get different kinds of humanoid creatures living on planets that have exactly the same kind of life or age span is highly improbable. This is something that is completely overlooked when you bring up the fact there may physically be at one particular moment, say, trillions of planets that are somewhat alike and capable of supporting life. So whether it is mathematically probable that they are supporting life at the very same moment that the other is highly improbable.
Well, we're making usual mistake of confining our possibilities into the very small spectrum of life that we have on Earth. There's life that has to resemble life on Earth. If we're talking about a carboniferous life, we are confined in a rather small area of temperature. We aren't confined to any atmosphere. There are all kinds of conceivable carboniferous life that can exist without an atmosphere. We need an atmosphere because we acquire our oxygen by breathing it. It would be perfectly possible to acquire it by heating it or obtaining it in any other way. We're controlled by temperature because in a carboniferous life we always find a carbon-to-carbon bond somewhere in the atom. And this is a bond that is very sensitive to temperature. It isn't a strong bond and it breaks down with temperature. So we have a small area of possibility of life as far as temperature is concerned. If, however, we replace the carbon atom with silicon, we'll find a much stronger thermal bond. And we've also begun to discover that silicon is capable of entering the practice all of the combinations that carbon enters into. It's perfectly possible, according to our own physics today, to assume a life which is based on silicon rather than carbon. And according to the temperatures, which is these temperatures will resonate. We could have intelligent life on Mercury. We hear now a lot of loud guffaws when we speak of life on Mercury because the temperature there is around 400 degrees. And we say, well, a human being would immediately shrivel up. But the silicon life would thrive very nicely at that temperature. We are so accustomed to confining everything within the little range of our own in consciousness are only things that we are accustomed to hear, that we have difficulty in realizing that this is only a very minute part of the total possibility of the universe.
Lecter Del Rey?
Well, I wouldn't exactly argue against this, because I wrote a book about it about 4 or 5 years ago, using silicone life and even using pure energy life on Mercury. I think, however, regardless of what type of life it is, if we assume, and we have a certain amount of right to assume it, that there is life somewhere in the cosmos, like us, or not like us at least, to be somewhere near or above our stage of technology, nobody can dispute it too much. But then when you consider the number of saucers that have been sighted, if they are coming from outer space using a tremendous amount of energy, why should there be dozens or hundreds of them flying around? One, yes, I might even buy one with a reasonable amount of evidence. 10? Does that mean from 10 separate systems? And that is pretty fantastic indeed. The probabilities have been completely upset. Or 10 from a single source? Why would they have to send 10? That's a tremendous expense of energy. Absolutely fantastic amount of energy necessary to get here. Even any reasonable length of time. When one would do everything certainly that they have been doing.
Why do we have to consider this such a tremendous expense of energy? It requires quite a bit of energy to put a satellite into orbit, but it doesn't require much energy from there on. Our satellites now. Well, this is a comparative thing. I mean, we're working up to distances traveled versus time. But our satellites make almost a round trip to the moon every day. A round trip to the moon about every day and a half in their orbit. And the only reason they don't continue this indefinitely is because there still is a little air that they come in contact with, a little gas, which eventually slows them down. If this were in space, they'd continue on a wireless attached to an airplane without any additional supply of energy at all. Once we have acquired the given velocity, and once we have something that is sapping that energy, we don't need any more. So we require only the energy to start at whatever velocity it goes.
Yeah, but a satellite is quite different from what a theoretical idea of what a saucer is. A satellite requires an initial burst of energy which puts it into orbit. Once in orbit, I agree with you, it requires no additional energy.
Well, if it reaches escape velocity,
yeah,
it won't require any additional energy.
A saucer, according to the various theories I've heard, is an intelligently piloted craft that enters and leaves the Earth's atmosphere at will, which requires tremendous energy available at a moment's notice.
According to our concepts of energy, which are still very, very limited.
Well,
we still have the idea that energy is something like money that has to be earned before it is spent.
Well, up
and
to the
must
present,
be spent to create any change.
Well, up to the present moment, I have never seen a free energy motor demonstrated.
Well, I'm not speaking of free energy motor now.
That doesn't mean it doesn't exist.
I'm not speaking of free energy motors now. I'm speaking of differential reference points or changing reference point. If you happen to be on the Earth, on one of two objects which is traveling through space, we will say they're traveling through space to given velocity. There isn't any way we could prove it unless we compare it to something else. We assume that these have, say, half the velocity of light. They're both traveling side by side, exactly parallel paths. Observing the other one, would say there was no kinetic energy present at all. There's no way in the world he could observe any kinetic energy present unless he observed a third spot. If another body of matter, another planet, were moving in the opposite direction at the same velocity, then he would say that each of these two planets had a very high velocity with respect to the third. This would be true even if we assume that the third were stationary in space. So how much energy an object possesses is determined entirely by the reference points which you adopt in making that measurement. It has no basic value at all.
Ellery?
I want to get back to that list, Ellery, leading into it a little earlier, and I recall the analogy that Charles Fort described of Columbus and the fact that he came over with not one, but three ships. And the Indian tribes that first saw these ships coming over the horizon of the ocean were seeing unidentified floating objects out at sea. And word undoubtedly spread amongst the various tribes across the continent and down to South America that unidentified floating objects were seen out at sea, and then these objects landed, and they had very strange equipment and strange manners, something that the people who were native to the American continent had never seen before. And then after a while, more and more of these unidentified floating objects arrived in the western hemisphere until finally what we have tonight has come to be. And, of course, I think that this could be paralleled by the flying saucer bit, and we are the savages who will be taken over very shortly.
Except for one point, Ellery.
You're very weak and safe, Ben.
I can take you to a little town in Italy called Genoa, to the city hall, and preserved under glass in a little thing called a birth certificate, an honor that says Cristoforo Colombo. This man was born, lived, and died.
Yes,
real.
Okay. Yes.
Well, you show me some documentary evidence about the inhabitants of the flying
saucer. Well, this discussion might have occurred amongst some Plains Indians who heard rumor of unidentified floating objects.
But however later it was substantiated, a man called Christopher Columbus actually.
Indeed.
Well, it was substantiated by a relative amount of evidence. We have some documents on it, which might be correct.
You got a birth certificate of a Venusian?
If I had, someone would say, oh, this could be fake.
Sure, yeah, but Columbus and his group did not come over and then run up and down the coast aimlessly, bobbing from place to place, picking up a few people here and there, and this continued for 10 years while dozens of the things come over. No, they stopped, they took on water, they did a lot of things, and only as many generally came as there was some purpose for. Some purpose which was surprisingly normal, such as locating riches, contacting the Indians. They took some of the Indians back with them, but the Indians who wanted to see them had a long time in which they could go out where this ship was anchored and see the ship.
I doubt, however, whether the Indians knew what these purposes were or could fathom the purpose of these people. And probably there were very many legends.
They weren't that dumb.
There were probably very, very many wild stories going around among the Indians.
I think about 100 years later, Sitting Bull had a full realization of what the white man was.
But that was 100 years. Tremendous parallel in history at this point. And as I recall, in history, Columbus brought back some potatoes.
New world.
Yes.
Let me ask you this, Dan, who want to hear this experience that you had a few years back in a flying saucer. But before we get into that, I understand that a man who impressed a number of people at this last convention, at the 5th Annual Interplanetary Spacecraft Convention, was Reinhold.
If he has no realization of what
preconceived opinions, preconceived ideas, preconceived desires can do to the things that our sensing equipment brings to the brain.
A story can go almost anywhere from there. Actually, the statement we made is comparatively simple.
Well, many astronomers have observed the canals on Mars, and many astronomers claim that they have never been able to see canals on Mars. And the thing is still being discussed, and various explanations are given. And it is generally accepted that certain astronomers did see what they thought looked like canals on Mars. At the same time, there is no general agreement as to the fact that they really did see these things. There's a lot of theory as to whether the canals on Mars are optical illusions or something that goes wrong in the eye of the observer. We don't know.
Yeah, well, this is true. However, I'd like to point out that the weight of opinion as far as the canal eye, which Schiaparelli first reported, is swinging strongly toward the existence of something on the surface. It is becoming cumulative, especially since we got what's called a memory tube, in which a single individual flash from the planet can be maintained for some time on the scope.
Something, but not necessarily even straight lines.
Oh, no, that's true. There was, before the last approach of Mars, the proposition was put forth that if these canali were observed and they proved to be great circles, it would be a tremendous additional amount of evidence that they were man-made. The only report that was made after the near approach, and there wasn't very much observed during that near approach. The only report that was made was to the fact that they were great circles that we've seen. Again, this is testimony. It has an amount of value which is dependent upon the individual who received it, what interpretation he wishes to place upon it.
There were many reports of flying saucers having had occupants who looked like human beings and who were about 23 inches in height, and who were killed when their saucers crashed and so on, and yet none of this evidence has ever been presented publicly where it could be evaluated.
Well, this is, again, as a comparative thing. I could agree to the extent that I haven't seen the alleged bodies of the alleged individuals. So as far as I'm concerned, it hasn't been presented to the public. I don't know how many people may have seen. As far as I'm concerned, it hasn't been proven to me.
Going back to the Book of the Dead again, Dan, as you probably know, people came in these ships and were seen to come out and go back in, and they departed for other regions in the outer space or other planets, whatever it might have been.
Quentin, did you say you read that in the Book
of the Dead?
I didn't
read it, sir. I didn't read it.
I have read the Book of the Dead, and I could never find a reference to a flying saucer in that book. I don't know where it has been dug up.
Did you read it in Egyptian?
I'm not trying to be funny. I'm against it. He may use entirely different. That is quite true. I have read it in translation. I know a little of the hieroglyphics, but I can't read them. The men who translate them at least know it better than anybody else who do no good to read in Egyptian. They at least are the most skilled to determine the meaning.
That is not always true, though, is it, Lester?
It
for
is
example,
in the translation of the Bible out of Hebrew.
Oh, well, there are all kinds of reasons for that. But these men are probably the only great scholars of Egyptian ones who have made the translation.
That's the assumption. No doubt they are.
There are some few
good
scholars
from the subject. Yes. I have a chap who spent many years in Egyptology. I mean, it happens to be a hobby of his. It isn't his vocation, so to speak. It's really an avocation. And I simply recite what he has told me. I haven't had occasion to read.
According to his information, the Egyptian Book of the Dead contains stories of sightings and contacts with flying saucers. How long ago would that be?
Well, the Book of the Dead, as you know, already is written around 2300 or 2300.
That adds up to about 4,000 years.
Yeah. And back.
And the flying saucers, it is claimed, contacted our Earth about 4,000 years ago and had conversations with the ancient Egyptians.
Previous to that, too. This is nothing unusual.
Previous to that? How much previous to that?
I don't know.
Because there you go back to a certain distance and come to the end of writing and records.
This again becomes available, depending on what authority, you accept. If you place any values in the writings of a man like James Churchward, he will demonstrate
by the translation, the direct translation of his writings that went back to his father.
I don't know.
You have a skeptic here. Again, well, again, that's what I say. If you wait. Now, I wasn't there 25,000 years ago or the time that he speaks of, so I don't know. I just have to accept his testimony on the subject is the only testimony that's available, as far as I know, as to what the translation of these tablets which he gathered meant.
If there are fairies, there is probably magic.
Well, this could be a situation where it was logical, however. You're speaking now of Atlantis and Lemuria, which Churchward, of course, went into, and so did Ignatius Dombey, who was called, really, the father of Atlantis. And for man to have progressed, as we have seen, from his early beginnings, his early history, as we know it today, the records which are available, up until the present time, in which I think Einstein, before he died, stated that in the last 10 years, man has lived 1,000. We are going at such a fantastically accelerating rate that if we don't control these horrible weapons developed, we can very easily find civilization missing on the face of this planet. Which means, I presume, and that's again assumption, that we would be starting all over again. And if this could be true, then why couldn't it not be true that Atlantis and Lemuria did exist, and the civilizations predating those existed and passed away?
Why could it not have been? It's not much evidence. Why could it not have been all kinds of fantastic things? Why could the moon not have been ripped out of the Pacific Ocean? There are some reasons, because the only reason that I can give is it cannot have been for purposes of my discussion, because I have no evidence that it was.
Well, on the other hand, we can't deny it for that. We can't deny the possibility for that.
The burden
reason.
Of the proof rests upon the man making the statement or propounding the hypothesis, not upon the man who has not accepted it.
Well, that's true. And we have to go on that. On the other hand, Lester, people are, when they're so imbued with what their experience has been, limited as it is, as you know, you contact hosts of people, I'm sure. And all they can accept is what they know. They haven't bothered to investigate. Now, if they were to talk to Ben Isquith here, a cybernetician, Ben's knowledge is vastly superior to the average. And they would, if they didn't know what you know, they could say, Ben, that your points were wrong. And yet, you know that a good many of them are far from wrong. They are demonstrable, they're provable, and in time, these people will come to believe it. After they have enough people state it over a long enough time. Because repetition.
That brings up an interesting point, Court, is that constantly I hear it brought out about limited people, who are bound by their experience and they won't believe things that are outside their realm of knowledge and all the rest of it. You brought up an interesting point that I've always insisted upon, and somehow I've never gotten across, is that the daily, everyday activity of most modern scientists, in his daily 9-to-5 work, he entertains the most fabulous, unorthodox, unbelievable, contrary to common sense suppositions as everyday working knowledge. These men are not habitually grounded to disavowing any sort of unorthodox, slightly out-of-the-way theories. They are open to everything. They also opened up the scientific method. Now, I think there's one case in point which I think is extremely beautiful. I mean, I think about 2 years ago, you could have gotten laughed out of existence if you mentioned the word abominable snowman. And I remember being laughed at hilariously with a group of my friends saying, I think there's something up there. I think there's something running around on those mountains. And finally, lo and behold, the Russians verified it. Of course, the Russians verified it had to be true, but these are the most practical people in the world.
Incidentally, I think I should remind our listeners that we have a teleprinter in our studio. This makes it possible for you to participate in the discussion in the morning. You can pick up your telephone, ask for the local Western Union operator in any community where you may be at the present time. Tell the operator that you'd like to send a telegram to Long John Watts, WUX, New York City. WUX are not the call letters. Please remember that. They are not the call letters of this station. That is a word. It evidently signifies to the local Western Union operator in your community that we have a teleprinter and they send the message to us in...
That's what, sir?
Yes, yes.
Is that HLK anymore?
No, please. Don't ask me any questions about
next
it.
Next week, East Wind?
I don't know. They change and change and change.
Well, that's to keep you alert, son, and young. And you're very young.
I don't think it's very practical, though.
But some of the operators,
John,
will
take walks. When I called in the other night, he said, Long John, New York, huh? Don't bother with the rest of it.
I don't know.
So, went to you, Long John, Long Island.
If you want to send a telegram,
surely.
Just send it to Long John Watts, WUX, New York City, and we should have your message in 3 or 4 minutes. I'd like to take a moment to talk about one of our sponsors.
Talking this morning with Dan Fry, the man who will be giving this lecture at Palm Gardens Ballroom, 52nd Street and 8th Avenue at 8 p.m. tonight, Saturday night. Tell your friends about it. I think you'll be very interested in having the opportunity of meeting Dan Fry and hearing the story, and actually he has many additional things that he'll be talking about, which we will not have time to discuss this morning. My other guest this morning, Ben Iswith, the cybernetician, Ellery Lanier, fact editor of Fantastic Science Fiction, Cortland Hastings, business executive, and Lester Del Rey, the famous science fiction author, and you'll find an article every month in Fantastic Universe Science Fiction, something that's been written by Lester Del Rey. I think you wanted to get in something about the snowman.
Yeah, I wanted to give my friend Bennett with some more support so that his friends wouldn't laugh at him. I think they're very cruel. tonight in the mail, as I got home, I got an advertisement for a book from Doubleday called The Third Eye.
Mm-hmm.
Have you seen that?
Mm-hmm.
But at any rate, what he pointed out was that the last point in one of the things that you find in this third eye was the incredible fact about the Yeti. Y-E-T-I-S, or Yetis, I guess, the fabled snowmen of the mountains. So after all, Ben, I guess perhaps you were just ahead of your time. So here you have a man who lives there, corroborating your own. I hear Lester tinkering, so maybe he doesn't agree with it.
Yeah, well, there are sometimes incredible bugaboos in science, like the old bugaboo that you could never exceed the speed of sound, someone could be Ivan Sanderson tells a beautiful story about a scientist standing in front of a
great story originally.
Yeah, well, it's a wonderful story anyway. Someone standing in front of an artillery cannon, explaining that nothing could ever exceed the speed of sound while these shells are going off every 5 seconds or so, that it keeps flying, that are being shot at faster than the speed of sound, and the business about the bombless snowman always was nothing could live up there, and which is the Himalayan monkey has lived up there for God knows how long, and has lived, and there underneath the snow there's quite enough vegetation to support life, especially for these monkeys who know how to get at the shrubs and the rest of it. And they've been living on a very fine how many years. I mean, so these wonderful bugaboos that are, just punctured, just look at them.
Well, Ben, you may not remember because you're kind of young, but my dad over here, Long John, he'll remember when the automobile first came in. Many, many men said, well, a person couldn't live if an automobile got up to the fantastic speed of 60 miles an hour.
Yeah.
We think that's very slowly.
You couldn't breathe at that speed.
Yeah, let's consider a more modern scientific bugaboo, Long John the subject. I remember very well a book which was written by Dr. Millikan, any time he was teaching at Caltech, at which time he was considered about as good an authority on the subject of nucleonics or nuclear physics as existed at the time. This book was published in 1935. It's still available in, I think, any good public library.
What's the name of it, then?
I'm trying to think.
Excuse me, I didn't
remember. Millikan hasn't written too many. You can probably find it because it's on physics, book on physics. Okay, and he devoted 2 chapters of this book to proving logically, mathematically, beyond all reasonable doubt, that man could never create any significant amount of nuclear energy. And he did a very thorough job. He devoted 2 chapters, and he considered all the possibilities, and they were known at that time. He considered first the possibility of fission of uranium-235. He demonstrated that it could never be separated from 238, so no chain reaction could ever be produced, because or identical chemically, they enter into the same combinations. And while there is a very slight difference in mass, it's so slight that it could never be separated to the required degree of pureness. And that anyhow, there wasn't enough uranium around to have any significance. Then he took up the possibility of fusion of hydrogen. And he showed that while this could occur, it could occur only in the remotest depths of intergalactic space where the pressure and temperature were at absolute zero. This is only a couple of years before the carbon cycle of the sun was accepted, in which this goes on beneath the surface of the sun, where quite probably the temperature is somewhat above absolute zero. But he did a very complete article, very well done. He started the article with this statement. For thousands of years, man has been deriving all of his useful energy directly or indirectly from the sun. And after having examined all of the possibilities, he concluded with the statement, for thousands of years, man has derived all of his useful energy directly from the sun, or directly or indirectly from the sun. And it is my considered opinion that if civilization lasts for the next 50,000 years, at the end of that time, man will still be deriving all of his useful energy directly or indirectly from the sun. If all of the possibilities of nuclear energy were gathered together in one place, we might be able to keep the whistle on a corner peanut stand going for a long time to come, but that is all. I remember reading it, and my first thought on the headlines of the papers about Hiroshima, my first thought was, what a tremendous peanut whistle that turned out to be. But here was a case where a physicist had said something was impossible. And it is perhaps poetic justice that in every case in history where a physicist has ever said that anything was impossible, he has lived to see himself proven wrong. And of course, Milton learned his mistake. But it's one of two cases. A physicist very seldom ever says anything was impossible. The greater physicist he is, the less often he says it. But in history, every time a man has said something was impossible, he's lived to see himself proven wrong. He said, in 50,000 years, it can't be done. And in 10 years from the time he said it, man had done it. So it's just an evidence that our present authority, or our authorities a few years ago, or our authorities a few years from now, will not be absolute. We tend to base our beliefs, the possibility, on present concepts. But if we examine history a little bit, we'll see what a continuous change that is involved.
End all these debunking stories about science. I'd like to go over the most famous one about Hegel. At the time, he was the reigning monarch of German philosophy. Students would gather a species of essay wrapped in every pearl of wisdom was brought. From his lips, he published a paper proving by his philosophy mathematically was close around it, that there could only be, I think at that time he said there could only be six planets, because that was according to thesis, antithesis, and synthesis of his philosophy and all the rest of it, there could only be six planets, there couldn't possibly be any more. And sure enough, the day after he published his article, they discovered the planet, I think it was Uranus, which at that time was the seventh planet. And he was delivering a speech on this article he had published, and going into this elaborate proof that it could only be six planets. And of course, there was some snotty little brat of an astronomy student sitting in the back who knew that there was a seventh planet. And when Hegel had finished his brilliant exposition of why there could only be six planets, the student got up and said, but here, Professor, experience tells us there are seven planets. And Hegel puffed himself up and said, so much the worse.
Ellery?
Well, so much the worse for experience will probably happen in a very short time in connection with flying saucers. That is what I would add at this point. How much the worse for experience.
Well, what kind of experience, Ellery? This is about the fact that because they never believed it 100 years ago and now it's true, it's some kind of proof. I remember listening to a very pathetic conversation where there was this bedraggled bohemian painter down in the village who had he was an awful painter. He was sitting there in half in his cuffs explaining that they laughed at Rembrandt and they laughed at Michelangelo.
and these men turned out to be great. So the logical conclusion of his theory was they laugh at him, so therefore he's going to be turn out to be great.
Well, this does not follow. This is a very simple trick to use to prove anything that you happen to want to prove. But I think the thing that comes out with the flying force of it is that the large majority of flying saucer sightings that I have heard of and that I have read about have always had a question of morality involved with these flying saucers. These beings who are flying the saucers were very good. They haven't really hurt us yet. They have very fine intentions. They're going to correct all the evils for the world. And the majority of the reports I have come across are simple reflections of wishful thinking and daydreaming and hopes for some salvation to come from a machine in the sky.
This points out exactly the point that I've mentioned before, that we don't know how much our observation is colored by our pre-existent wishes and desires. I don't think there's any question in the world that there's a tremendous amount of chaff existing about the subject, one of the things that makes the investigation of it very difficult. But the fact that chaff is there does not dispute the validity of the subject at all, because this chaff occurs whenever a subject is basically sensational in nature. I've pointed this out many times, and that is if a sensational crime is committed, if a small child is kidnapped, and newspapers all over the country carry headlines on it, the detectives and the newsmen are going to investigate that. Know perfectly well in advance that within a couple of hours you're going to start receiving reports from all over the country that the child is seen here, there, and other place, in this circumstance, and weather circumstance. And they know that the critical factor is going to be involved. It's been known for decades that 80% of all of the data they're going to be called upon to examine will prove they have nothing whatever to do with that crime. But they know this in advance. They don't go out and run down a few clues and find they have nothing to do with it and say, well, that proves positively that there never was a kidnapping or such child ever existed. We'll go home and forget about it. If they did, they wouldn't solve very many crimes. But we don't think to apply the same 80% factor to the investigation of this subject, which is just a sensation. It is significant that for 2.5 years, the official group that investigated the subject, whenever questioned about their investigations, had the same reply. They said 80% of all of the reports that we have investigated have proved to have perfectly normal earthly explanations. And then they promptly neglected the names and went back and explained the 80%. They always discussed the 80%, never the 20%. Now, they didn't have to spend 2.5 years investigating the subject to learn that 80% had proved to have nothing to do with the subject at all, because it's a factor that's been well known for a long time. It's a very critical amount, very critical figure, because it's been around for a long time.
Corlin?
Ellery, I don't think you either meant what you said or meant to have it sound as it did, which was that the majority of reports had something to do with morality, because the majority of reports certainly have nothing at all to do with occupants as such. They have to do only with sightings. There are 150 names of men in this issue right here. There are many, many, many times this number on file for the National Investigations Committee on Aerial Phenomena in Washington. And not one, bear in mind, not one of those has to do with any morality nor any occupants as such. So when you say that, I don't think you meant that. And I simply, for the interest of the listeners,
I have not had the opportunity of meeting and speaking to every individual who claims to have sighted or have flown in a flying saucer. But what I did state was that within my experience of contacting people with stories of flying saucers, this has been the case. There has always been this sort of dreamy, hopeful, wishful fantasy that we're in a lot of trouble here on Earth, and these wonderful beings, these marvelously intelligent beings are going to come and get us out of hot.
Well, the ones that you have seen, of course, have been the ones on Long John's program, and actually
the ones that have been on Long John's
program. Boy, I knew you weren't trying to let me get away with that one. I didn't mean there was anything wrong with them, O'Shea. I simply meant that you have collected those, naturally. You had the most interesting and personal stories to tell. You haven't gone to the airline pilots here. Naturally, you don't know them, and they're probably not available anyway.
Oh, I have met some of them.
I'm not calling them.
None of them are permitted to appear.
Yeah. Well, all I was trying to do was limit Ellery's experience to those who had personal contact, whereas there are hosts of others.
Don't get me wrong. I want to be on the record as I don't want to be on the record as denying the existence of flying saucers. I have never denied the existence of a flying saucer or spacecraft from outer space. I would be the last one to deny this.
I wasn't trying to put you on that spot either. I was just seeking the truth.
Dr. Holloway, who was on the program a short while ago, told me, he saw this in my aura, that I would be flying in a saucer sometime next year, and I look forward with great joy to this experience.
Well, perhaps that will be true, Ellery. On the other hand, this is one of the things we don't know about, so we put it aside.
Let me interrupt for a moment to take care of a little business, and then we'll be back with our guests in the morning.
Ellery, question. Do I understand that you're at the recent Grand Chancellor Convention or meeting at Giant Airport then?
Yes.
This is a human equality, human factors question I'm asking you. Were you aware that approximately the same time, give or take a couple of days, there was an infected meeting of the American Medical Society in Los Angeles, which is not a great distance from Giant Rock?
Yes, sir.
What I wanted to know was there any kind of liaison between these two groups? Because as I understand, an important part of the American Medical Society's meeting was a concern with what they call biosatellites or spacecraft to carry human beings. And the Giant Rock meeting was concerned with a similar question. Did you come across any liaison between these two groups?
A certain amount, yes. That's a touchy subject. Matter of fact, there were a number of members of the American Rock Society present there. I don't know whether they'd appreciate having the names mentioned or not. Among some of our people present together, you're going to find a few from every walk.
Do you think they were there just to sort of kick?
They were probably there for a number of different reasons, just because two of them were there.
Members or associate members?
Of which?
Of the American Rocket Society.
Two were members.
Probably
associate. Now, I don't know how many were there. I certainly didn't know among the 10,000 there whoever from what.
If anybody can be an associate member, practically.
I'd like to make this suggestion. I know that, at least I think that everybody sitting around the table here would be interested in hearing Dan Fry's experience in flying saucer. I know Cork is familiar with the story, and I think that each one of the panel members sitting around this morning would certainly like to question Dan about the story. I would like to suggest that Dan tell us the story. Maybe we should interrupt him, let him tell us the entire story, and then we possibly can take maybe 15 minutes for each one of the panel members to question them about the story.
How long do you want to spend in the statement?
You mean about the start of
this event? Yeah.
Well, it only took you 32 minutes to go from New York and back to the White Sands Proving Ground.
Whatever time you feel would be necessary, if I have to interrupt to do a station identification, I'll try to do it at a logical point.
The point is, I think it should be done as rapidly as possible to give more leeway for questions.
If I had to bring out all of I'm familiar with the story, and to me it's a very, very interesting story, and I know our listeners would like to hear it firsthand from you without being interrupted. And then afterwards, we can take some notes. So I'd like to have you tell us, please, what were you doing? I think you were with Aerojet Corporation at the time. Give us the whole story.
The point I'm making is how much basic background development should I put in the story and how much should be brought out in the questions. I like to do it as rapidly as possible. I realize that in a statement, the fact such as this isn't going to furnish a basis of acceptability for anybody. If I were to have come to this microphone 3 years ago and told a story of a hollow metal cylinder that I knew of that was moving in an orbit about the Earth from some 200 miles up to some 1,300 miles out. It was traveling at 18,000 miles per hour, swinging around the Earth about every 110 minutes, and there was a little dog riding around in that hollow cylinder. I would have been laughed off the table. And rightly so, because I wouldn't have
furnish any grounds for belief.
Any basis. In order to furnish any grounds for belief, I would have had to go into the science of architecture itself, what the purpose of putting this dog in this sphere. If I'd merely mentioned that bald fact, it would have sounded the most ridiculous thing you can imagine. It would be perfectly correct in that, because there'd be no basis for belief or understanding of the thing at all. If you tell the story of rocketry up to the point, show how it developed, why the dog was put in, how the thing was carried, and then say that he was an arbiter, it's something that becomes reasonably acceptable. But this takes a tremendous amount of time to do. So I will go over what occurred at Einstein's cooling down on this particular evening. Quickly as possible.
Well, there's no need to rush. In other words, you take as long as you feel that it's necessary to tell the story, and then I know that the various gentlemen sitting around the table will have questions.
Yes, that's right. But
they can make notes during the time that you're.
I want to give it just sufficient detail to allow a basis for intelligent questions.
Fine.
And I'd like to do that as rapidly as possible.
Fine.
The event referred to took place on the evening of the 4th of July in the year 1950. At the White Sands Cooling Downs, where I had been sent by the Aerojet Engineering Corporation, which is now Aerojet General Corporation, to set up some instruments for the testing of a very large rocket motor. It was designed, I believe, to boost the Northrop sled, and was also used later for a booster for a plane, which I don't think has been built yet. It wasn't a very successful motor, but that's neither here nor there. That was the reason I was at White Sands at that particular time. On this particular evening, I had intended to go into Las Cruces to do a little celebrating, as had almost everyone else in the base area, but owing to a little misinformation on bus departure time, I missed the last camp bus in town and was stranded at the base. I went back to my quarters, room 6 in the H building, directly across from the officer's mess, and began to do a little studying on heat transfer from a book by James Cork, because it was a subject I was particularly interested in at the time. And it turned out to be a very appropriate subject, because just about that time the air conditioning system quit. It was just a large evaporator cooler, a large blower, driven by a motor that was considerably underpowered. It heated up and it had a thermal cutoff switch, which shut it down. Theoretically, when the motor cooled down, it was supposed to start again, but it usually didn't. Almost any of us could have repaired this condition, but by military regulations, only maintenance men are allowed to work with maintenance equipment. And the maintenance man, of course, was in Las Cruces, so it was practically everyone else. After the building had reached an intolerable temperature, I decided to go out and take the hike. I started first toward the static test stand area where we had the motor set up, about a mile and a half from the base itself. But halfway there, I passed a small road which turned off to the right. Now, this isn't really a road at all. It's hardly more than a set of wheel tracks, but I had heard stories of the miners' diggings and the interesting things along this small road. It's the only road in the area I'd never been over. And I thought, as long as I'm just hiking anyway, this is as good a path as any. So I turned off and started down this road. I'd gone perhaps half or three-quarters of a mile when I observed an object coming toward me come over the peak of the Oregon Mountains, which rise abruptly behind the base. It appeared to be descending at an angle of about 45 degrees, moving quite slowly. If I had to make an estimate, I'd say around 20 miles per hour when I first observed it, but it was apparently decelerating as it approached the ground. It seemed to be controlled in such a way that its velocity was always proportionate to the remaining distance between it and the ground. Touched earth about 70 feet from where I was standing. There were no propeller blades. There were no jet streams. There was no outward evidence whatever of the application of the force that any of was controlling. Until it touched the ground, it could have been a light of an aircraft. It could have been a part of an inflated balloon, although it didn't have that appearance. And anyway, there wasn't any breeze blowing, and yet it had a fairly good horizontal motion. When it touched ground, it landed on a clump of brush, and I could hear the brush crackling quite briskly. which moved the last possibility that it might have been a lighter than aircraft, or essentially lighter than aircraft, because some of this brush is fairly stout. At that point, the possibility occurred to me that this might not have been created by earthly technology. At that moment, it seemed just as fantastic to me as it could to anybody else. I had not been accustomed to thinking in these terms at all, but on the other hand, I had been connected with prophecy for some time and with aircraft before that. And in connection with the work, I felt that I had at least a slight knowledge, slight familiarity with all of the types of airform that we were building or even proposing to build at that time. And I knew that this didn't bear the slightest resemblance to any of it. It occurred that the only logical answer to this was controlled by some sort of field mechanism because there was no lack of evidence. And at that point, I began to have a strong desire to be somewhere else. I think perhaps the only thing that restrained me from breaking into a run was the fact that I realized that nothing I could do would be more sure to attract attention to myself. Actually, I froze or made motions for what seemed like a very long time. It was probably only a couple of minutes. The craft, after settling, made no move, but the judge was silent. And I began to have an equally strong curiosity about the nature of the craft. When eventually started to approach it and stretch and pause and stretch and pause. If it had moved or made any sound at that time, I probably would have been running yet. But it was completely silent. My curiosity grew as I approached it. And I finally got quite close to it and circled around it. At that time, I saw no hatches, no seams, no doors, no means of ingress or egress. It was simply a smooth, polished metal spheroid. And I thought momentarily, if anything was in this, if there was any operator or operator mechanism in it, it must have been put into the top or bottom. The bottom was on the ground, and the top, of course, was above my vision, because it was about 30 feet in diameter and about 16 feet in height. This is a pure estimate. I had no opportunity to measure it. And it appeared to be silver in color. And I say silver advisedly to distinguish from the hard white finish of stainless steel, nickel, or chrome. I'm familiar with these alloys, and I don't believe in some of them. It could have been silver, it could possibly have been platinum, it could have been an alloy of both, or again, perhaps something entirely different from either. I think that's the appearance it has. I could see a good reason for using platinum, if it happened to be available in large quantities for a paving for such a craft, because it's almost entirely impervious to all sorts of corrosion and is one of the most temperature resistant of all metals. So I don't know whether that's what it was or not. I never found out. After circling around it, I paused to decide what should be done next. The obvious answer was to rush madly back to the base and rouse a few other people and get them to come out and see the thing for himself. And I started to do it. I'd taken perhaps a half a dozen steps when I suddenly got the horrible picture of the position I would be in if I did rush back to the base, rouse some other people, and get them to come out, only to find that this object had taken off in my absence. I felt that there was very little chance, if any, that I could ever persuade anyone that I had actually seen it. I was employed at that time in a capacity which was such that it did happen that at times the lives of other people were to some extent dependent upon the accuracy of my judgment. And companies do not hire mentally unstable people to fill these positions. And I thought if this thing is going to be around here from now on, tomorrow will be soon enough to get someone to come out and look at it. If it's going to take off almost immediately, the best thing that I can do is find out anything I can about it now and just hope that I survive to make a report. There didn't seem to be anything more I could do. I'd already been around it, but it did occur to me that I hadn't actually touched it yet, or I'd been close enough for some time. And I stepped forward and placed my fingertip of injury to the surface of the metal.
was perhaps a few degrees above air temperature. It wasn't noticeably hot. There was a quality about it that is difficult to describe, difficult to accept. It seemed to be exceedingly smooth, but it was more than that. It was exceedingly slippery, and even more than that, it was impossible to produce any friction between my fingertip and the surface of the metal. Now, no matter how highly polished the surface is, if you put your finger on it and press, you'll produce friction. When I put my finger on it and pressed even straight down, the way I thought was straight down, my finger simply drifted around on the surface from one point to another. I didn't understand this at all at the time, but I began to stroke the surface of the metal in the palm of my hand. And I could feel a slight but quite definite tingling between my fingertips and the heel of my palm. And at that time, I was addressed by a voice. And this is the point at which eyebrows begin to go up, because the voice employed the English language and the American idiom. The tone of the voice appeared to be normal. There was no noticeable accent, although we deal with so many accents in this business that you don't notice it unless it's very pronounced. But the idiomatic phrases that were used, in some cases, were put in places where they would not normally be used by the people who were using them. It was as though the individual using them could not distinguish between idiom and what we call real words. All of this didn't impress me at once. The first thing that happened when this voice immediately warned me against touching the surface of the crack. But when it suddenly crackled out, the current is from the edge of the craft there, while I leaped backward a couple of steps and got my heel tangled up in some brush, and I sprawled out in the sand. And at times such as this, I guess the mind works very rapidly. And I could say that my past life did not flash before my eyes. I was much too concerned with the present and the immediate future. But I did remember hearing what sounded suspiciously like a chuckle, and my first conscious thought was that whatever is observing me, whether it's from Earth or somewhere else, it apparently has a reasonably well-developed sense of humor. And since a sense of humor is one of the prime attributes of a high degree of development, and if it has, I'm probably not in any immediate physical danger at the moment. And I also remember the fact that if this craft is from somewhere other than Earth, and if I am being observed by its occupant or its operator, and currently I am, then this is undoubtedly the most undignified position from which the representative of one race has ever greeted the emissary of another. I didn't think in those words, of course, but the picture came to me, the utter ridiculousness of my position sprawled out there with my feet in the air. And we always think of a meeting between various races as being connected with a large amount of pomp and ceremony. We always have the take me to your leader idea, and we think of the preliminaries being undergone and the bands playing and the radios blaring, and then with great pomp and ceremony the two come together. This, judged by that standard, this seemed to be utterly ridiculous. But the voice then spoke again and assured me that I had nothing to fear. I found that I could ask questions and get answers. And as everyone here may readily imagine, I became very full of questions. To every question that I asked, I got a complete, logical, and in almost every case, an understandable answer. At that point, my reason had been completely convinced that this craft could not have been created by any technology on Earth. My ego was far from convinced. This is the problem, I think, that complicates the investigation or the acceptance of the simple fact of extraterrestrials, that our ego always gets in the way. We've been born and raised secure in the belief that Earth man is the supreme product of the universe. And while we may outwardly say, oh yes, our reason tells us that there are others, Our ego finds it very, very difficult to take the step down necessary to allow for the existence of someone who may perhaps have achieved a slightly higher degree of development than we. We seek escape mechanisms, we seek explanations, we employ sophistry and everything under the sun to get away from accepting the simple fact. We've been doing it for centuries. But I asked questions, and I got answers. And in most cases, the answers were couched in terms which always brought the proof or the evidence of the correctness of the answer in with the answer itself. It was the logic of a force that I had never encountered before, and yet simple terms are always used. I wish I could have made a case about it, because I couldn't possibly quote it exactly, although I did the best I could in the report which I subsequently issued. But even so, my ego was still battling acceptance of the fact, and I did express a certain amount of skepticism to a couple of the things that were said. As a result of that, I was offered the opportunity to make a short test stop in this craft. I was not offered to use for the purpose of proving anything to the world. It proved something to me. At that time, I was perhaps as skeptical an individual on a subject like this as you could have found. I, too, outwardly was perfectly ready to accept the possibility. But when it actually came down to accepting the fact, this was something entirely different. A theoretical acceptance of a possible extraterrestrial somewhere in the universe is one thing. The actual act of talking to one and informing me was something else. I can't accept it. But I was offered the opportunity. After some discussion, I accepted. I wasn't particularly afraid of any physical harm, because if the operator of this craft had any desire to do away with me, obviously the simplest thing in the world would be to pick the craft up and set it on top of me. I actually was probably a lot safer inside than I was outside. There was the question of whether or not I would ever return, and this did occur to me. But again, I was basically in a position where I had no real choice in the matter anyhow. If the operator of that craft, with whatever abilities they obviously had, I wouldn't have had any chance one way or another. So I accepted. There was some discussion previous to that in which it was stated that this craft was not designed or intended to carry passengers at all. That it was a remotely controlled sampling device that was being used at that time for the purpose of taking samples of Earth's atmosphere at ground level from various isolated points on the planet. It was evacuated at the control ship to sit down on various isolated points on Earth, and the valve mechanism was opened, whereupon it would become filled with air at the pressure and temperature that existed at that point on the surface. First part I can understand, because the question is the right sense. Every one of our upper atmosphere research vehicles had somewhere in there vacuumed out, arranged the valve to open at a predetermined elevation to take a sample of gas. This was merely a case where the samples were being taken on a much larger scale than we had yet been able to do. But it was stated that there was a small emergency passenger compartment in this craft, just as we build emergency passenger capacity in almost every sort of freight vehicle that we had. And that if I chose, I could ride it. And as I already said, I tentatively accepted the invitation. The valve mechanism in the top was opened. I could hear the inrush of the air. It didn't seem to have nearly as much volume. The sound didn't have somewhere nearly as much volume as it should, because it required only about 15 seconds to fill the crack. And all I heard was the sound of somewhere beneath it, between a murmur and a whisper or a whistle. Not nearly loud enough, I thought, to account for the role that should be produced with that much inrush of air. It occurred to me later that the craft probably was insulated, and so would be almost entirely soundproof, and most of the sound of the inrushing air would be made inside. But after it had been filled, an opening was created, a hatch, if you choose to call it so. That's probably the most precise description of it, a section of the hull about 5 feet in height and 3 feet in width, moved inward couple of inches and then sideward into the recess in the hull. And the wall of the hull, well, the wall of the hull was 4 inches or a little more in thickness at that point. The material of this door or hatch is perhaps an inch in thickness. It moved inward slightly and went sideward into the wall of the hull. I didn't have opportunity to examine the operating mechanism. I did see that it was a ground joint, apparently. There were no visible gaskets. I was still looking for possibilities that this craft could have been created here. I never found any that completely excluded the possibility, but made it very, very improbable. We might be able to set up grinding equipment with sufficient accuracy to grind a block of metal 5 feet in height and 3 feet in width with a compound curvature, which you would have, because it was a part of the hull. We might be able to grind it with sufficient precision to produce a hermetic seal. But I wouldn't want to be the engineer to set up the grinding equipment. I'd rather leave that to someone else. The construction of the craft that I observed could have been done here, but it wouldn't. All the aspects that I observed were at the very top of our present technology. It would have been exceedingly difficult to accumulate all of these top achievements in technology into one vehicle. The opening that was made revealed a small segment of the craft, about 7 by 9 feet, with a ceiling slightly more than 6 feet, between 6 and 7, I estimate I could touch the ceiling, above a floor which was 12 to 14 inches above the ground. Walking forward toward it, of course, my head entered the opening before my feet because of the curvature in the hull. My head was inside, and I looked in. I saw 4 seating devices. We would call them chairs. They didn't resemble exactly anything that we have here, nor yet were they very different. There were no flat areas. They were continuously curved. We would call them body contour chairs, except that they were not reclining as ours usually are. They were reasonably vertical. At the back of the wall, the back wall, where it reached the ceiling, about the center of the wall, there was a lens and tube arrangement protruding from the wall. And from this, a glow was being emitted. It wasn't a beam of light, it was just a glow, and it didn't seem to be particularly strong. But it was giving plenty of light for a comfortable seating in that small compartment. This and the chairs were the only instruments and devices which I observed in this craft at all. Was exceedingly simple. The walls were curved or beveled while they fit together. I didn't see any sharp edges. On the other hand, the walls were straight, were plain, except where they met, where they intersected. After another minute of hesitation, I was again invited to enter if I chose. There was no urge. It was just given a choice. If you want to try this thing out, try to get in. If you don't, then that's something else. So I finally stepped up on the floor, and immediately I did so, the door closed behind me. There was a small click just before this door opened, prior to my entrance, and just before it closed, after I had entered. This was about the only sound. That and the sound of entering air, I think, were the only sounds that I heard at all during the entire period. This click could have been a single arm relay, it could have been a small solenoid, or it could have been any one of 100 other devices. But it's the only sound that I remember hearing. After the door had closed, as I heard it begin to close, I whirled around, and I think if it hadn't closed rapidly, I would have probably dived out of the opening again. But it was closed, and at that, I decided that I was in it now. If it was a trap, there wasn't any point in fighting the inevitable. And I was then asked where I chose to go. And I said, well, it doesn't seem to make any difference. I have no idea how much time you have, how much time you can spend, or where you can take me in that time. And anyhow, it won't make any difference because I can't see out of this thing and I don't know where I've been. The reply was that I would be able to see
at least as well as you can see from any aircraft in the air, which isn't too much except flight patterns on the ground. And that if I had no choice in the matter myself, the sight that had proven to be more impressive than any other to them had been the light pattern of the city of New York from about 20 miles up. And if I chose, they could show me this light pattern. Well, I did a little rapid computation. I know it's almost exactly 2,000 miles by airline from the proven ground there to New York. A round trip would involve 4,000 miles. And I was curious as to how long this would require, and then so it was about 30 minutes. Well, this was not difficult. I mean, except it was not particularly important, the velocity alone. Because we were firing missiles even at that time, which had terminal velocities of around 4,000 miles an hour, from 3,600 to 4,000, which was half of that speed. And men could have ridden in them any time they chose at that time. And it's also a well-known fact that man has more than doubled the top speed at which he can travel every 10 years for the last 50 years. During the last 10 years, he has much more than doubled. He's doubled and tripled it, and is going on from there. And so that speed alone would involve only a 10-year hence over our abilities at that time. Actually, now, that speed is old hat. That's very, very slow as far as modern missiles that we have here are concerned. If we couldn't produce a higher velocity than that, we couldn't be in the business at all. But at that time, it was considered by many people to be a fantastic velocity. Still is by many people who don't realize that we have orbital vehicles going around the Earth all the time at much higher velocities than that. But I was concerned with one thing. I wasn't concerned at all with the velocity. I was concerned with the acceleration. In order to travel at high velocities, of course, we have to accelerate. And I looked at the seats. They were metal frames with apparently plastic material molded directly onto the frame. We make a lot of upholstered furniture in which we use metal and plastics, but we almost always sew our covering on. We take a frame of metal, we put on foam rubber or something as a padding, and then we sew a polyvinyl chloride or some other type of covering, hard covering, over it. I didn't see any seams in this, although I didn't examine it that closely. There could have been seams, but I didn't see any. And it appeared as though it had been molded in one operation. Again, this is something that we probably could do, but I don't know that we ever have. But there were no seat belts. There was no evidence, apparently, of preparation to absorb shock. And one of my first questions was, how in the world will I take the acceleration? We don't even have seat belts in this craft. The reply was that I wouldn't have to worry about the acceleration. I wouldn't even feel it. And this, of course, brought a great big why, a big question to my mind, because acceleration has been the bogeyman of aircraft missile engineers for quite a long time. So the reply was that the speaker, who purported to be the operator of this controlled craft, was well aware of the fact that this was a serious problem at this time. And that this fact had proven to be one of the greatest disappointments to them in our evaluation of the level of intelligence of the future of Earth. They were aware of the fact that a couple of our great physicists, or reasonably great physicists, had made the public statement that if these craft actually accelerated at the rate that they had been observed to accelerate, then there could be no life as we know it aboard these craft, because no life as we know it could endure up due to acceleration. And that statement to them was a very great disappointment in their evaluation of our level of intelligence. That the answer was very, very simple, and that even a reasonably intelligent layman, with the knowledge which our average layman has here on Earth, he should be able to refute this statement at once. The reason that we are concerned with acceleration is because we produce that acceleration by applying a force to a limited portion of our craft. We have a propeller blade or a jet stream, which applies thrust to a limited portion of the craft. This thrust accelerates the craft, but does not accelerate the pilot.
The pilot is accelerated only by thrust against those parts of his body that are in contact with the seat. Seat moves forward and pushes against him and accelerates. But his body has inertia and tends to remain where it is. So his body is crushed between the thrust of the seat and its own inertia. And if this is what produces the feeling of acceleration, in extreme cases, it causes displacement of the blood and blackout, or even actual crushing of the body. In their case, the acceleration is produced by a field mechanism, which is equivalent to, in fact, is identical with a gravitational field. And a gravitational field, as we know, does act equally upon all mass within the area of its influence, regardless of the nature of that mass. And that anything within that field will have applied to it an exactly equal amount of force per unit of weight. And each and every individual atom of mass will be equally accelerated. There will be no displacement, no force, no strain upon any part of the body. And under these circumstances, the upper limit of acceleration is only the limit of the available force. This seemed to me to be a perfectly simple and logical explanation. I was very ashamed of the fact that it hadn't occurred to me before.
But even so, after I had my university door was closed, and I had seated myself, certain was made that they would now demonstrate how it was possible to see from the craft, and this glow which was coming from the projector, whatever we might call it, the back of the room, suddenly ceased, and for a moment or two, the compartment became totally dark. And then it apparently again became active, some sort of display or beam was emitted by it. I think it was far beyond the visible portion of the spectrum, but there was this light by glow connected with it. This might have been caused by refraction from the molecules of gas itself, the air in the compartment. I don't know.
I'm sorry to interrupt at this time. This is WOR Radio, your station in New York, 710 of the dial. Continue, Dan, please.
But when this glow, this ray, this beam, whatever you might call it, I hesitate to use terms that have become corny for overuse, this energy played over the surface of this opening, this door, it became transparent. As transparent as any glass that we have.
And this again raises a big question in my mind. How can this be? How can opaque materials become transparent?
The answer to this wasn't complete. It did indicate the lines, but in the first place, we here don't have too much knowledge of why one material is transparent and another is opaque in the first place. A pane of glass is just as dense and as hard as most metals, and it transmits light. Actually, there is plenty of space for photons of light to come through any metal. Even the densest metal we have is still practically out of space. But in one case, the photons of light are absorbed by the outer ring of electrons in the material, either absorbed or reflected by it. In the other case, depending upon the configuration, in some cases crystalline material, in other cases though, amorphous material, because glass is amorphous, it isn't a crystalline subject, it's a supercooled liquid. But that whether or not a material was transparent depends entirely upon the configuration of the structure, not upon its density or its mass. And that this force that was being played upon simply prevented the photons from being absorbed by the electrons in which it sat. So it transmitted light. Anyway, all of the ramifications of the theory, I know that it did transmit light because I could see the area in which I had just come, the area of the sand and the brush. I was then told that the craft was about to take off. And in spite of the fact that I had been told that I would not feel the acceleration, I automatically reached down and grasped the sides of the chair and braced myself for the shock of takeoff. As I looked through the window, transparent window, I suddenly observed that the earth fell away from beneath the craft. I say it fell away because I felt not the slightest evidence of motion at all. It was all its snouts were fast, it was moving, but it was rather the earth that was falling away. I observed almost instantly the lights of the base area, which had been hidden behind a low hill, perhaps 15 feet higher than the area in which the sphere was located. And as soon as I observed them, they appeared to be drawing together. The distance between each light seemed to be diminishing. It wasn't too high, but I estimated that about 2.5 seconds later, I could see the lights of Las Cruces.
On the lower left-hand corner of the viewing screen, our window, and there's a hill that's about 500 feet high between Las Cruces and the base area, and the hill is about 5 miles from the base area.
And calculating it afterwards, I arrived at an approximation that indicated that the acceleration was about 10 Gs. Now, this isn't a startling acceleration. We have missiles that have much higher acceleration than this. But it is a rather high acceleration to undergo without feeling any effects of it. As the craft continued upward, it rotated slightly to the left. And I could observe the highway from Massachusetts toward El Paso. I couldn't see the highway itself, and the cars upon it, but I could see a very thin pencil of light. It was a holiday, of course, and the road was jammed with cars. I could see this, I could see many other lights, of course. And I could trace the light, this highway, in toward El Paso, which at first was just a dim glow on the horizon. Then as we continued to go up, it appeared to come into sight. It appeared to come constantly closer. And finally, I could distinguish the army base area there from the main portion of town. I could see the city of Juarez across the river, and finally could, or at least imagined, I could see the thin black line that represented the river. So, the viewing screen is still rotating, and as we rose, I could see as light patterns of other towns, but the other ones I couldn't identify, because they were southeast at that point, and I didn't know the town. After 10, 12, 15 seconds, the intensity of light of the stars, I could see a few of the stars which are close to the horizon. The angle, of course, of this bar, for that, I think, was very much above the level of my line of sight. But the sky outside appeared to get much darker, and the stars appeared to increase in brilliance. And I assumed that perhaps we had begun to enter the stratosphere. I questioned this, and the reply was yes, that at that moment the craft was rising at about 0.5 mile per second. Now, again, this is not the time of last year. This is half the time of the last few feet from the old V2. But that it would be taken up to approximately 35 miles elevation, at which point the residual atmosphere was not sufficiently dense to seriously impede the progress of the craft. And that the horizontal flight would be made at a level of 35 miles. This horizontal component began to be added, however, to the vertical rise at about, I think, 14 or 15 miles. The craft took an eastward course. I could observe the light patterns of the cities over which we passed, and as we passed over each one, they were named to me. I had no way in which I could tell whether those light patterns actually represented the cities that were named. I only knew that they were named in the proper geographic sequence. But when we approached the city of New York, the level was dropped to about 20 miles. It was stated. Now, there was no alternative craft. These things I was taking on faith, coupled by a certain amount of calculation, verified, I might say, by a certain amount of calculation. I know approximately the rate at which the line of sight increases with elevation. And you can see at any time a number of different cities, the light patterns of a number of different cities from a given point by determining the line of sight. I would say that the elevation probably was approximately 35 miles as stated. and it was probably dropped to about 20 miles when the craft made a circular pass over the city of New York. Coming from the west, it swung toward the north, and there toward the east, and toward the south, and then back, just a large circle. During the circle, the viewing screen, or whatever we choose to call it, was kept toward the center of the city. The craft revolved as it rotated, so the viewing screen was always toward the center. So it appeared that the city was rotating about a point at the center.
Rather than so we were going right, the velocity was lowered to a few hundred miles an hour while this pass was being made.
After the pass was complete, the craft again headed west, retraced its steps, and was landed at approximately the same position, the takeoff. And I was requested to leave. The door was then open, and I was requested to leave. I stepped out. I took a dozen or so fast steps. And then I turned to look back, and the door had closed, and I observed an orange-colored band of light appear about the widest portion we call the equator of the craft, and it again leaped upward. Now, I didn't observe this band of light while inside, although it wasn't too wide, but it would have been above the level of the viewing screen anyway. But the craft again moved up. But apparently about the same acceleration it had when I was within. As it went upward, this band of light spanned the spectrum. It went from the orange to the violet end of the spectrum. By the time it had reached the violet end, it had risen too high to be followed any further. It seemed to have passed out of sight. After it had passed out of sight, I felt it quite a loose end. I can understand how those who have a close contact with this craft inevitably are connected to some extent with religion, or at least with the deeper values of life, because at that particular moment I felt as though there simply was no further excuse for my existence. An hour or so before that, I had been a rather self-satisfied, perhaps slightly conceited technician, engineer. I was there to set up instrumentation to test the largest rocket motor that had ever been built. And while I realized that my part in this program was a very small one, nevertheless, I liked to feel that I was right up there in the forefront of science. I was helping to lead the van. After 30 minutes aboard this craft, I realized that no matter how successful that motor turned out to be, it was still laughably and hopelessly obsolete. And with that realization, there suddenly seemed to be no further excuse for my existence, because that had been almost the sole reason for my existence up to that time. It took some little time to reorient my mind and realize that there might be other values, other things worthy of pursuit. Anyway, that's the card seems to have an adjustment, and after time, I head back to the base. I dropped into bed and eventually fell asleep. And it was near dawn and I returned. It was broad daylight when I woke, and immediately memory came rushing back, and again I attempted to escape. I thought, well, what could this have been? Could it have been a dream? Could it have been hallucination? Could it have been temporary insanity? And I wanted to think that it was anything but fact. Because even then I had begun to realize the impact that this would have on my life if it did turn out to be fact. I couldn't see anything that I could gain by it, and I could see a tremendous amount that I might lose, just as an individual. And as soon as I'd completed the few jobs that I had to do, I hiked back to the same area to see if there was any evidence that this had actually happened, and hoping that I wouldn't find any. And when I reached the spot where I remembered seeing me track them down, I found there a fresh patch of brush. I found a circular row of footprints, 30 feet, and first in line, squaring this. My footprints were visible all over the places. I looked down the top, and it was fairly hard, but there was enough left there to indicate that someone had made a circle around something. At one point, a row of footprints went in from the circle and suddenly ended. It went in a few steps and suddenly ended about where I had remembered being aboard the craft, and about 4 feet to the right, another row of footprints started and moved outward toward the periphery of the craft and beyond. I even walked in on the footprints going in and attempted to leap into the air and turn around and come down on the footprints coming out to see if I could have done this while sleepwalking. It didn't seem possible, but I need to check all the possibilities. I found after half a dozen attempts that I couldn't do it. I was forced to the conclusion that I had been aboard something. And if I had, then there wasn't a logical way that I could escape from the rest of it. For quite some time after this, I said absolutely nothing to anyone about this experience. I know that this is another case where I had been...